This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Mel Brooks wrote and directed such hilarious film comedies as Blazing Saddles, a spoof of Westerns, High Anxiety, his comic homage to Alfred Hitchcock, Young Frankenstein, his version of a classic horror film, and History of the World Part 1, his send-up of Hollywood spectacles. His film The Producers was adapted into a Broadway musical mega-hit that won a record-breaking 12 Tonys, including Best Musical. His latest project is his new memoir, All About Me. Brooks is one of the few EGOTs, meaning he's received an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. To top it off, he was a Kennedy Center honoree, received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Film Institute, and a National Medal of Arts, presented by President Obama. I love his work, and I love talking to him, and I'm grateful his memoir provided another opportunity to have him on our show. Let's start with his most hilarious and intentionally tasteless song, Springtime for Hitler. It's from The Producers, which is about two theater producers who figure out a scheme to make more money from a flop than they could make from a hit. They stage a musical called Springtime for Hitler, which is in such bad taste, it's bound to be the flop their scheme requires. The title song is a big production number featuring singing and dancing Nazis. Here's the version from the 1967 film.
Germany was having trouble, what a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
We looked around and then we found the man for you and me. And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany. Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Mel Brooks, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is such a great pleasure to have you back, and congratulations on the new memoir.
Oh, thank you, thank you.
In writing this book, what was the process of reviewing your life like for you emotionally, going back through the ups and downs of your life?
Well, it was a little crazy. Sometimes I'd be remembering a childhood episode, and suddenly I'd find myself crying. And I said, I mean, that's not like me, but you never know what's going to, you know, how you're going to be assailed and assaulted by memories.
What made you cry?
Well, I think it was a happy moment, and I don't know why I cried. It was getting a box of chocolates after being run over by a car, a box of chocolates in the hospital. And I said, I remember saying, boy, it was worth it. When I got that box of chocolates. And then for some reason that made me cry. I mean, just thinking of this little naive kid who equated chocolates with heaven or something. It was just, I don't know. You never know.
Well, you very casually mentioned getting run over by a car. You were roller skating and in the street, and a car that you didn't see just kind of, one tire ran over your stomach. And
yes.
I'm reading that thinking, oh, my God, like, that could have killed you.
Yes, absolutely. It knocked the wind out of my sails, I'll tell you that.
Well, how afraid were you? I mean, what a terrifying thing.
I was 8 years old. I wasn't scared at all. It's just a thing that happened. I was practicing my eagle turn, and I think I must have had my eyes closed in order to feel the eagle turn properly, and then suddenly I was knocked down by this car. Luckily, it was kind of like a tin Lizzie, a very light Ford, and I remember being knocked down. I remember the wheel, the left front tire, bouncing on my stomach, and then bouncing back again. I remember saying, woof, you know, just a lot of air leaving me.
So your father died when you were two of tuberculosis, and it wasn't until you were six that you realized other kids had fathers, and you didn't. And you're right, it was a brushstroke of depression that never left me. A lot of comics have dealt with depression. Has depression been something that you've dealt with over the years beneath all the comedy?
Not so much, not so much. When I'm asked what was the happiest time of your life, was it marrying Anne Bancroft? Was it winning the Academy Award? Was it writing your first sketch for Broadway, for New Faces? I cut them off and I say, I was the happiest, and to this day, probably the happiest in my life, from 5 years old to nine. Those 4 years were blessed with running, Johnny on the Pony, Kick the Can.
Getting run over by a car.
Getting run over by a car, playing with my gang and, you know, in the streets, and just being free and careless and reckless and just a happy, happy child. So there was a lot more happiness than there was depression. There was a brushstroke, I said, just when kids in school talked about their mother and father, and I could only talk about my mother, but they'd say from 4 to 9, I mean, what happened at 9?
I was going to ask you that. Yeah. What happened at 9? Yeah.
And I would usually say homework.
Oh, and right.
Homework. And I realized they want something back. They don't let you get away with it. You can't leave school and then run in the streets and be reckless and wild and happy. They want something back. So they want an hour or so out of your life. A very important time right after school, so you could see your pals, your buddies, and that homework was the first realization that you had to give something back to the world to earn your space in it.
You wrote that most of the kids in your neighborhood, and it was a largely Jewish neighborhood, grew up to work in the garment district in Manhattan, moving racks of clothes. My father worked in the garment district. What made you think you could carve out a different life, one in show business?
Well, it happened one fateful night when my Uncle Joe took me to see my first Broadway musical. And it was the Cole Porter, a wonderful show called Anything Goes, starring Ethel Merman. And he knew the parking attendant in front of the theater who actually got him the two seats, and we were way up in the second balcony. And when Ethel Merman sang, you know, You're the Top, I mean, she was a mile away, and there were no mics in those days, and I told my Uncle Joe, boy, she's loud. I mean, that's how loud she was. That's how definite she was. She was amazing. But that show changed me and changed my life. And my hands stung from screaming and applauding so much after it was over. And I remember going back in Uncle Joe's cab, and I remember saying, you know, as he was driving me back home to Williamsburg, Uncle Joe, Uncle Joe, I want to be part of that show. I want to be in show business. I'm not going into the garment center. I'm not going to be pushing a rack of clothing to the post office. I'm going to write songs. I'm going to sing songs. I'm going to go into show business. And I knew it. And I never deviated. Of course, I took many different jobs before I finally, you know, got to do that. But I knew it then and there, formed an arrow heading for show business.
So let's talk a little bit about your songwriting process, because I love the song satires in your movie, including the song High Anxiety from High Anxiety, and you know, Springtime for Hitler from The Producers, and The Inquisition, What a Show from History of the World Part 1, and Jews in Space.
So
tell me something about your songwriting process. Like when you would sit down to write a lyric, the lyrics were often like the parody of a genre. And it might be the parody of a film genre or of a song genre. So, like, would you, like, listen to a lot of songs of the period you were satirizing or, you know, read, like, books of that period to get, like, the language in your mind? Like, what would you do?
I think I'd get the words first, or at least the first. I remember in when I was doing The 12 Chairs, I wanted a title song that would say who these people are. You know, there a lot of peasants, a lot of people, emotional people, were characters in the movie. And but I needed a song to capture all of this emotional expanse of the movie, and it hit me. Hope for the best, expect the worst. I just had that. And then I got that second line. You never know what's going to happen. So hope for the best, expect the worst. You could be Tolstoy or Fanny Hurst. No way. No. And I went, you know, I talked a lot about chance and about how you never know. You never know how your life is going to go. And I needed a tune, and I heard, I think I heard something from Brahms, but it also, Brahms had stolen it from some Hungarian tunesmith, and I loved it, just the basic ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba. It fit my title. And from then on, it just flowed. It just flowed. It was like Niagara Falls. It just flowed.
I love that song, and I've adopted Hope for the Best, Expect the Worst as my motto.
I wrote a brilliant, I got to give pat myself on the back. I wrote a brilliant release, my own tune also, the middle, the release, interlude between the choruses. I met a man who made a fortune that was splendid. Then he died the day he went to go and spend it, shouting, live while you're alive. No one will survive. Life is sorrow, here today and gone tomorrow. Live while you're alive. No one will survive. There's no guarantee. Hope for the best. And he goes, but that middle part, I am so proud of. Live while you're alive, no one will survive. That's a great, simple, profound, wonderful lyric. Thank you, Mel. You're welcome.
I want to quote something from the book. You write, even though it seems foolish and silly and crazy, comedy has the most to say about the human condition. Because if you laugh, you can get by. You can survive when things are bad if you have a sense of humor. I want to talk with you a little bit about being 95, which is what you are now. Are there things about aging that you can laugh at, that laughter is helpful at, and things that you can't laugh about being 95?
Yeah, well, that's good. That's a good question. I don't have a ready answer for that, but it's true that, you know, I'm so grateful to be able to eat scrambled eggs and toast and for breakfast and sometimes a roast beef sandwich for dinner. I'm so happy that I still have somewhat of an appetite. I'm having trouble sleeping. That's a problem. But otherwise, things are pretty good for being 95. And I'm getting around fairly well. And my basic, emotional attitude is still more positive than negative. I'm still saying, I'm still looking forward to talking to people, to meeting people, to having dinner with people, and I was looking forward to fresh air. I was looking forward to talking to you, and I knew it would be good because you're always so damn good.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you very much.
I always listen to Fresh Air when it's not even me. That's how much I love you.
Being Jewish has always been part of your humor, and kind of most dramatically in the producers and production numbers like Springtime for Hitler. You grew up pretty secular. Your grandmother was observant, but your mother not so much.
Yeah, right. We used to hide the ham from my grandmother. Thank God. The tenements.
Oh, the non-kosher ham. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Right.
So what does it mean to be Jewish now for you at age 95? Have you become any more or less observant? And is like religion something you want at this point in your life? Or Are you remaining as secular as you've always been? Is there any kind of difference to you?
No. Being afraid I'm going to die has not made me more religious. I'm still... I'm tribal. I love being a Jew, and I love Jewish humor, and I love the je ne sais quoi that the Jews, they have a wonderful attitude. You know, I guess it's called survival. But I was never been, for instance, I was so glad to not drink Manischewitz wine anymore. Gene Wilder introduced me to Nuit Saint-Georges one night at dinner at his house. I said, what is this? I said, is this wine? Because I thought wine was this tepid kind of sweet.
Like grape juice with alcohol in it.
Yeah, yeah. That was Manischewitz. He said, no, this is a Burgundy. It's from, you know, France. And I said, wow. But Gene saved my life. No more Manischewitz. But actually, it has to do with... It really started with when the synagogues in Brooklyn charged money on the high holy days, not much, I think maybe $5 a family, and it wasn't much to keep the synagogue going. My mother simply didn't have the money. Therefore, we were very rarely in a synagogue because it cost $5 on the high holy day. So, but I loved going to Passover dinners at my grandfather's house in Bensonhurst. I loved the trappings of being a Jew.
The culture, dinners, the ceremonies, yeah, the jokes.
Yeah, the jokes, the jokes, exactly. The jokes.
What kind of reviews did you get from rabbis about your Jewish humor in especially your more sacrilegious Jewish humor in movies?
Boy, when I did The Producers, I got 1,000 letters, mostly from rabbis and Jewish organizations. How dare you? It's a Holocaust, you know. And they were right and they were wrong. And I would say, you're not wrong. You're absolutely right to take offense at it. But let me tell you this. If we're going to get even with Hitler, we can't get on a soapbox because he's too damn good at that. We got to ridicule him. We got to laugh at him. Then we can get even. And sometimes I'd get a letter back saying, maybe you're right. You know, it was okay.
Are there any jokes that you wish you could take back?
No, not, I can't, I can't, not really. I would, not one would I take it back. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty upset about some jokes that I took back that I didn't let go, that I thought, well, that's a little, you know, outside the pale, that's a little too, you know, risque, and I kept, you know, but there were plenty of jokes I should have just exploded with, and I said, maybe that's a bit too much for the kids or whatever.
Can you give us an example?
I can't. I could give you one, but it was just too dirty.
Ah.
You got to hear it, right?
I got to hear it, right.
Well, it had to do with Madeleine Kahn going into Cleavon Little's dressing room after the show during Blazing Saddles. And
this is your spoof of Westerns.
Yeah, spoof of Westerns. And then she says something like, relax, you know. And then she says, oh, how are you, you know, how were you built? Beautiful. Yeah. And the joke was something about, it's true, like the way you're built, you people are built, you know. And it was too much. And she's, he says, I'm sorry to disappoint you, Miss von Strupp. You're biting my arm, you know. So it was a big, it would have been, you know, today I think I could have gotten away with it, but never then. Yeah.
So you took the arm part out of the movie?
Yeah, I kept him in the dark, but I never did that joke.
That is so funny. So I have one last question for you. You're 95 now. You've lived a long time. What is the meaning of life?
I haven't figured it out yet.
You're 95. You've got to know. How else are we going to know if you don't know?
It's a very good question. And maybe in my second book, History?
Yeah, the sequel. Volume two.
Volume two, the history of Mel Brooks, part two, Maybe I'll figure it out. But so far I haven't. But I don't want to get, too close in case the answers are negative. I don't want to know, I want it to be up and at 'em and positive and fun. And I still love comedy. It's my delicious refuge from the world. I hide in humor and comedy. I love it. Anyway, it's always good to talk to you.
It's always good to talk with you. You've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk with you. And thank you for writing your memoir.
Oh, please. And it was a pleasure.
Please send my regards to your son, Max.
I will. I intend to. And I intend to make a copy of this thing and memorialize it. And, send it to Max and everybody. Send it to my pals. And, But a lot of people listen to Fresh Air. Believe it or not, a lot of people listen to you. I don't want to scare you and inhibit you.
I like the way you say "believe it or not." Like,
yeah, I know.
It's really hard to understand, but it's incomprehensible. But people listen to your show.
You're one of the few I could do that with without hurting feelings, because you understand humor and you understand comedy and its rhythms and how it works. You understand it. You're great.
Well, I love your humor, so it's. You've made me laugh so many times over the years, and I'm so grateful to you for that. So it's been a pleasure talking with you, and I wish you all good things.
Oh, bless you. Thank you so much. Terry Gross, I love you. Thanks.
Mel Brooks' new memoir is called All About Me. Stephen Sondheim died just 2 weeks before the release of West Side Story, a new screen adaptation of the classic Broadway musical for which Sondheim wrote the lyrics. Leonard Bernstein wrote the music. The new movie, which is now showing in theaters, was directed by Steven Spielberg and features a role for Rita Moreno 6 decades after her Oscar-winning performance in the original 1961 film. Our film critic Justin Chang has this review.
A lot of us had our doubts when we heard that Steven Spielberg would be directing a new version of West Side Story, and not just because of Hollywood remake fatigue. In the decades since it first appeared on Broadway in 1957, the Romeo and Juliet-inspired story of two warring New York street gangs has inspired more than its share of criticism, especially over the writing and the casting of its Puerto Rican characters. Even the beloved 1961 movie inspires groans now for having cast Natalie Wood in the lead role of Maria, and for forcing Rita Moreno, the only Puerto Rican in the cast, to wear dark brown makeup as Anita. 60 years later, Moreno is an executive producer on Spielberg's West Side Story. She also gives a poignant performance in the new role of Valentina, the widow of Doc, the drugstore owner. By her presence, Moreno teaches us how to approach this movie, as both an affectionate tribute and a gentle corrective. Spielberg and his regular screenwriter of late, the playwright Tony Kushner, give us a tougher, grimier vision of the Upper West Side in the 1950s. We see the working-class neighborhood of San Juan Hill, home to mostly Black and Latino residents, being demolished to make way for new developments, like Lincoln Center. There's a heightened sense of hostility between the Puerto Rican gang, known as the Sharks, and their white rivals, the Jets, and their rumbles are startlingly violent. Adding to the realism is the fact that the Sharks are played by actors of Latino descent. They include David Alvarez as Bernardo, the brash leader of the Sharks, and Ariana DeBose as his girlfriend, Anita. Both actors are superb, as is Rachel Zegler, making a fine screen debut as Bernardo's little sister, Maria. The story hasn't changed. Maria falls into an ill-fated romance with Tony, a former member of the Jets, played by Ansel Elgort. Here they are on Maria's fire escape, singing Tonight, one of the many classic songs gloriously revived in the movie.
Tonight, tonight, it all began tonight. I saw you and the world went away. Tonight, tonight, there's only you tonight. What you are, what you do, what you say.
Today, all day, I had the feeling a miracle would happen. I know now I was right. For here you are, and what was just a world is a star tonight.
What's remarkable about this and the other numbers is how brilliantly Spielberg directs them. West Side Story is the first musical he's ever made, but it's no surprise that he's a natural at it. Few other American filmmakers have a more instinctive sense of rhythm and visual flow, or more direct access to your emotions. He stages the numbers like an old-school Hollywood classicist, with none of the overly jumpy editing that might distract from the dancing. When the Jets and the Sharks meet up at a school dance, their clashing tempers and bodies pull you in with an almost physical force. And when Anita and Bernardo sing America, their rousing song about the pleasures and perils of assimilation, the scene builds from a domestic squabble to a joyous party in the streets, which Spielberg shoots in a vibrant whirl of color and movement. The Tony-winning choreographer Justin Peck rings some clever variations on Jerome Robbins' original dance moves, whether it's the Jets wreaking havoc in a police station house during their big comic relief number, G. Officer Krupke, or Tony and his friends tossing around a pistol during a tense performance of the song Cool. Speaking of Tony's friends, as Riff, the leader of the Jets, Mike Faist gives one of the movie's standout performances. The weak link in the cast is Elgort. He can sing and dance, but there's an emotional flatness to his acting that doesn't quite gel with the much livelier Zegler. Spielberg can't solve everything that's creaky and dated about West Side Story as a text, but he knows that the show still has something resonant to say about racism and violence in any era, including ours. The reason the movie works so well stems, I think, from a curious paradox. This West Side Story may be grittier and more realistic than the original movie, but it also feels more thrillingly old-fashioned than anything a Hollywood studio has released in ages. By the end, I wasn't moved so much by Tony and Maria's sweet, somewhat drippy romance, or the fatalistic drama between the Jets and the Sharks. I was moved by Spielberg's conviction, his sheer faith in the transporting power of movies. For 2.5 hours, he makes you a believer again.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. Coming up, we hear from Karen Culkin, one of the stars of the HBO series Succession. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Karen Culkin is one of the stars of the HBO series Succession, which is kind of a comedy disguised as a drama about personal and corporate power and greed and the ability of right-wing media to manipulate politics. The story revolves around the Roy family that runs the conglomerate Waystar Royco, which owns a conservative cable news network as well as a cruise line, theme parks around the world, and other businesses. The patriarch of the family, Logan Roy, played by Brian Cox, is old and has had some health crises that he nearly didn't recover from. His daughter and two of his sons have been competing to be the one who takes over from their father. Logan Roy has another son who wants to run in the Republican presidential primary. Each sibling will do anything to get power and undermine their other siblings' attempts to be the anointed one. When Kieran Culkin hosted Saturday Night Live a few weeks ago, he said this in his opening monologue.
I play Roman Roy. He's one of the nicer characters on the show, which still makes him one of the top 10 worst humans on TV.
Well, if it was ever true that he was one of the nicer characters on the show, it kind of isn't now. Culkin's character, Roman, is the most immature of the siblings. He's always jokey and ironic, often unpredictable, and uses his ha-ha-ha, I-didn't-really-mean-it attitude to gloss over his cruelty. This season, Culkin's character, Roman, has been trying to prove that he should take over the company, and he's been making some power plays to prove he can do it. On a recent episode, the Roy family was at the conservative Future Freedom Summit, where the political powers and major donors basically decide who the next Republican presidential nominee will be. The Roys have a lot of influence because they can use their network to back or undermine a candidate. And if their candidate wins, the Roys expect favors in return. In this scene, Roman is talking to a would-be candidate from the far right, who Roman thinks his family should support because this guy is already famous, he's good on camera, he's, quote, fun, and he can excite voters. He's a white nationalist named Jared Mencken. Roman is trying to convince Mencken they can help each other. This clip starts with Mencken explaining to Roman why he's against immigration.
People trust people who look like them. That's just a scientific fact. They will get more tax dollars to help them. Now, you can integrate new elements, of course, but come on, man. Slowly. I mean, I like this country.
Yeah.
Let's just take a beat before we fundamentally alter its composition.
Yeah. And in terms of, you know, this, here, there's a thing here. Right? Mm. And I get it. You're 6G and we're Betamax, but, you know, you need us, I think. Our news, our viewers, those almost deads, that's a big slice of pie.
Well, if I'm the nominee, are any of them really going to vote against me?
No, but, you know, it's going to be a show going into the convention. I think you could really use our push.
I think you could use mine.
Maybe.
Where are you in all this?
Me, Roman? You know, I'm creeping on the come up.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I've got some ideas for ATN, you know, sluice out the porridge and add some sriracha. Poach some of those TikTok psychos, you know, e-girls with guns and jewel pods, you know, give me some straight shot. Blacks and Latinos, no more of this pillows and bedpans, you know, we're strictly bone broth and pills. Deep state conspiracy hour, but with like a wink, you know, funny. And the whole show is kind of set up for the star, President Jared Mencken.
Kieran Culkin made his movie debut at age 7 in the 1990 hit film Home Alone, which starred his brother, Macaulay Culkin. He continued acting in such films as Father of the Bride and Cider House Rules. He starred in the 2002 film Igby Goes Down and co-starred with Michael Cera in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. They worked together again along with Tavi Gevinson in the Broadway show This Is Our Youth. Kieran Culkin, welcome to Fresh Air. It is such a pleasure to have you. I love the show. I love your performance in it. I love the writing. I love all the actors. Anyways, thank you for being on our show.
Thank you. That's really nice.
So that said, after all the praise, when the first episode was on, I didn't make it through the episode. I didn't like it. I thought these characters are monsters. They're like the most privileged people in the world. They're monsters. Why would I spend my time watching this story about them? And then I finally figured out through hearing other people talk about it that it sounded great and I should give it another shot. And that's when I realized the show is really funny. I mean, you wouldn't know it just looking at the surface because everybody is so in character and is so serious in the way they play their role. But the writing is just hilarious. Were you all worried about that, that there'd be a lot of people like me who wouldn't realize at first that it was really funny and would just kind of not care about these monsters?
I had the same feeling even while we were shooting it. I looked at the pilot script and I said, I know this is quality. As we were shooting it, I felt great about what we were doing, but I felt, who's going to want to watch this? Who is this for? You know, it's hard to just tell people, hey, it's good, watch it. Like, I just didn't think that it was going to have tremendous appeal. It's funny because I've been doing interviews since the first season, basically telling people, like, it's not bad at the beginning. There just isn't really anything that hooks you, I think, right away. I feel like somewhere in the middle of the first season, and I still don't know, I still haven't been able to identify what that thing is, but I'm engaged, and I care about these characters. I mean, I don't like them, but I care to see what happens with them.
Right, right. So, you know, in the clip that we just played, I'm thinking, has Roma just picked a candidate that would have been leading the insurrection?
Probably.
Did you think about that?
I did. But it's funny. He just goes on instinct. I don't think he went into that summit with this guy fully on his radar. Macon approaches him at a bar, and I thought, oh, this is a guy we can work with. This is a guy that if I form a relationship with him, I think what properly motivates Roman in this is strictly to be in Dad's good graces to position himself better. And if he finds the guy, then he's in a better position. And I think this is a guy that he felt he could work with. He asks him in the bathroom too. He says like something to the effect of fascism is cool, but not really. In other words, like you're not going to get me in trouble, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the only thing that can cause it. But otherwise, like, I don't really care what you do as long as you win and you and I. Roman has no care for what happens to the country or anything like that, as long as it puts him in good standing with Dad.
Yeah, and your character has no beliefs, no real moral center.
Yeah, probably not. I don't think he even has any sort of political agenda or of any kind. I don't think he really cares.
It's just about winning.
It's just winning, yeah.
You seem to have had this like approach avoidance attitude toward acting. There's been periods where you've acted and periods where you've decided to drop out. Has the show and its success and your fabulous performance and role in it made you feel any differently about acting?
Yeah, it was, you know, because I've been doing it since I was a kid. And I don't think, you know, when you're 6, 7 years old, you say, hey, Mom, Dad, I want to be an actor, that you're actually really making a decision for your future. It doesn't really, you're just a kid, you know? So I felt like I'd just been doing it since I was a kid and never actually made the choice to do it. And I think around the age 18, 19, 20, I found that suddenly I had a career that I never decided I wanted. And didn't really like that. So I kind of tried to stay out of the limelight as much as possible while I figure out what I want to do with my life. And in the meantime, I'll just do this acting thing as long as I like it and as long as I find a project that I like. I didn't necessarily pursue the acting career or success or anything like that. I enjoy doing work from time to time. But while working on this show, I can't remember if it was season 1 or 2, but I remember coming home from work one day and telling my wife, I said, it's going really well. And she said, I think I know what I want to do with my life. I think I want to be an actor. And at that point, I've been doing it for about 30 years.
Yeah. That's.
It just took that long. And now I feel comfortable with it. Now it's like before, I think I've always had this sort of, I had a relationship with it. It was a love hate. I loved doing the work. I hated all the stuff that came with it.
So let's talk about your early years when you were acting and it wasn't your choice. That choice was basically made for you, I think, by your father. So when your brother Macaulay Culkin starred in Home Alone in 1990, you played his cousin. What's the backstory to that? How did Macaulay end up starring and you end up playing a role in it?
You know, we got started all at the same time. And that was mostly my father's idea from what I understand. And he pushed all of us, there's 7 of us Culkins all together, but some just did not want to do it at all. And some took to it and kind of enjoyed it. So, like, I think a lot of times people think that, you know, my brother started and then some of his siblings joined in thereafter, but we had all sort of started about the same time.
What was it like seeing child stardom, watching your brother become like one of the most famous kids in America? Because Home Alone was such a big hit, and the whole thing with him like holding the sides of his face with his hands and going, ah, I mean, that was like, that was all over. There was no such thing as viral yet because there wasn't really internet yet, or not much anyway. So, but if there, like, it was the equivalent of going viral.
Yeah, it was pretty nuts. And I think what people sometimes fail to remember too is that, like, he was a kid. He didn't really choose that. it just something that happened to him. And I think when you're a kid, you obviously don't have the tools to handle something like that. So I think it might've been pretty tough. I've been saying it like this, like sometimes people pursue the fame thing and don't really realize what it is until it hits them. And I have a friend who basically had this experience where he had been pursuing acting, sort of thought, you know, success would be nice. And something changed overnight where his movie came out on like a Friday. And the way he described the story was he went out to dinner Friday night with his girlfriend and it was a normal evening. They went home. The next morning, they went to the same restaurant to have breakfast. And on the way, he got recognized. When he had, over the course of breakfast, his table got interrupted 4 or 5 times by different people. And then on the walk back, people were taking selfies. And by the time he got home, he realized his life was different and he kind of panicked. And since then has had a very hard and sort of tough relationship with his own fame. For me, I got to witness it. I got to sort of experience it secondhand as a child. So to me, I always have known this is not something one would want to pursue. It's not a very nice thing, fame.
Your brother had said that your father was emotionally and I think physically abusive toward him. And that at some point he basically like legally emancipated himself from your parents. He removed their names from his trust and appointed an independent executor to oversee his financial holdings. Was that your experience of the family too?
No, we had it. Our experiences were a little bit different. I mean, our father was very much a terrible person. I didn't experience much like physical or emotional abuse personally, but I'm sure Mac did. And I think it's so funny. It's been years. I've been meaning to talk to Mac about this for a long time. I feel like the emancipation thing is a little bit blown out of proportion. Basically, my understanding of it is there was a custody battle, like any other custody battle that was happening between my parents. The only difference was is that one of their kids had millions of dollars of his own, and it was becoming complicated in terms of what the court was going to do, because whoever gets custody of this kid also, you know, becomes the manager of his money. Cause you know, he was a kid. So he's not really in charge of his money. So I think it was more of removing it from the equation so that the custody battle can move forward. I don't think it was really him divorcing his parents, but it makes a really nice headline.
That's such a strange thing to think about, that the kid, the child during the divorce is the one with the millions of dollars. That's so topsy-turvy.
I know, but people look at it as like the parents were fighting over the money. They weren't. They were fighting over custody. It's just that one of the kids had a lot of money. That's all it was. It wasn't they were trying to take his money or take control of the whatever, but it was becoming very complicated with the lawyers and everything. So it was just, hey, you know what? Let's assign this guy to be in charge of the money until he turns 18 so that neither of the parents can touch it. That's my understanding of it, but I still haven't like properly talked to Mac about it because we tend to not really talk about crap like that.
Were you confused with your brother when you were young because you both looked similar? You were not far from age. So were you ever confused with him? And if so, what was that like?
Oh, I mean, like if people on the street?
On the street, like strangers on the street. Yeah.
There were a few. There was one time this woman, I was about 9 or 10 years old. I got out of a car. I think I was with my dad at an airport and she ran up to me. Like I barely took a step out. She must've thought I was Mac. And she ran up to me and she said, "Are you McCluckley McCluckley?" And I remember saying, "No, nobody is." And then she wanted to take a picture with me. And like, I was trying to tell her that I wasn't, but she still took a picture anyway. It was very, very confusing.
You're the father of two, and your second child was born over the summer. Your mother had 7 children, so she must have been pregnant a lot of the time and really, really busy, because I think she also worked. What impressions did it give you of parenthood to see her raising 7 children?
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's funny. I'm going to have to really think about this one, because, my mom, I was the 4th. So, you know, I do remember her being pregnant at least the last 2 times and being very busy. And the the apartment we lived in was very small. And in the morning, she would, you know, get the oldest few kids ready for school and the dad ready to go to work. And then she'd stay home with the young ones, which is usually like three kids and a baby maybe, and look after them all day. And then kids would come home from school. She'd see to that, dinner, all that stuff, get the kids to bed, and then she would go to work, and she would work nights. And I just don't know if she slept. I have no idea what she, but I know she didn't really ever sit down. She was always doing stuff. There's seven kids to feed. There was work to do. There was a very small and messy apartment to constantly be cleaning up. She happened to have a partner that didn't clean up. I have no memory of my father ever lifting a finger to cook or clean or any of that stuff. So she did that all herself. Now, before becoming a parent, I really enjoyed my free time and sitting down, and I could spend days lying in bed. Not only do I not have that luxury, I don't even understand that mode anymore. I feel like I wake up in the morning and I go to work and I just don't sit down. There is no sitting down to eat anymore. There's always something to do. And at the end of the day, there's still so much left undone that it just gets added to the pile of there's too much to do. So now that you've asked me the question, I'm wondering if maybe that's what I took from my mom. Watching her do that made me go into a gear of, okay, get to work.
Well, I love you on the show. I love the show. Thank you so much for being on our show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure being here. Thank you.
kieran Culkin is one of the stars of the HBO series Succession. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.